From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Okay, go for it.
Does that sound like me?
I don't know. I think the jury could be out. If it isn't you, perhaps the original Joe Duffy person will actually contact us.
We're all doing it now. You see, you're doing it now.
You're feeling worse. Your worse mental health. You go online, consume more negative information, makes you even worse.
The Pieta walk the other day was the first time a humanoid robot did a charity walk in the world. The first time a robot raised money for humans.
Coming up on this Manic Monday edition of Playback Daily, talk to who? What now for the Liveline voiceover guy? Shock report reveals that doom scrolling makes you feel bad. And Rise of the Machines, a robot raises money for people. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that for one welcomes our new fundraising robot overlords. This morning, Oliver Callan came in the shape of Dermot Whelan, and Dermot's monologue began with thoughts on the good weather most of us enjoyed over the weekend.
Glorious sunshine in most places over the weekend. It was just so lovely. And I think it just improves everybody's mood. But Met Aaron says the country is in for some mixed weather in the coming days. Today will be cloudier than the last few days with occasional rain or showers in parts and some heavy or thundery falls possible. It's as if the weather just jumps in and goes, they're getting too confident now. They're getting too much of a swagger about the weather. We're just going to throw in a little bit of rain to keep them honest. The best of the sunny spells will be in the west, which is great to hear. As a man who grew up in the West, we were constantly sickened by weather forecasts that said sunny spells in the East, and the East even got the best snow and used to encourage even more cries from my part of the world in Limerick of Dublin get everything. As they say, high pressure is likely to become dominant through the latter part of the week and for next weekend, bringing mainly fine and settled conditions. So next weekend is looking lovely from this point of the week anyway. I didn't see any photos of cans covering the Grand Canal in Dublin like we usually do, but there are signs and bollards and they've gone up on Drury Street in Dublin, which is near Grafton Street, which say, please don't sit on the curb, because hundreds of people have been doing just that, gathering on the street on nice evenings, drinking outside bars and restaurants, but it's causing a bit of bother for local businesses and for access.
Where there's a weekend, of course, there's sport. Lots of sport. And if you're a Louth person, this weekend was especially memorable.
Victory for the wee county in the Leinster final. Meath might have brought down Giants Dublin a couple of weeks ago, but in the end were outplayed by Louth. It was very, very exciting. They won the Leinster title, of course, for the first time in 68 years with a 2-point win. And if you're curious, like I was, about what Ireland was like the last time Louth won in 1957, Eamon de Valera was voted in as Taoiseach at the ripe old age of 75. And the most popular tune in the country was a tune by a chap called Paul Anka, and the song was Diana, and he began the song with an opening line, you should never ever say to a woman. A brave man, isn't he? Yeah, his follow-up single was, those jeans look a bit tight on you. Lots of commentators saying the new rules and the introduction of the two-pointers have made this year's GAA games much more exciting. I thought so as well. Indeed, it was a high-scoring 1-point win in Saturday's Ulster final as well, where Donegal pipped Armagh after 20 minutes of extra time. Both teams delivered brilliant football, and there was lads collapsing on the pitch with cramps after all that excitement. But Donegal held on against last year's All-Ireland winners. Sadly, it was all marred by a bit of a violent on-pitch fracas, or melee. Why are there such elegant-sounding French names for a load of lads doling out slaps? A fracas or a melee? At the final whistle there. And given the video clips circulating online over the weekend, disciplinary measures seem likely. Although there was a wonderful little glimpse, I thought, into the heart of GAA sport. When Donegal boss Jim McGuinness was asked his thoughts on the violent scenes, he said, I didn't see it. I was hugging my daughter. And I just thought, oh, Isn't that lovely? You'd never hear that after a Premier League game, would you? Limited action in Camogie, as to be expected with the whole Scort issue. Actually, if you really want to enjoy the lighter side of that whole debate, which keeps rambling on, I would recommend that you listen to Callan's Kicks, where he has Marty Morrissey squeezing into a Scort. On Sunday night, the Munster Camogie Council postponed Kerry and Cork, fixed for May 18th, until after that special Congress vote on Scorts set for May 22nd. In athletics, there was great news from China. The Irish women's 4x400m relay team have joined the 4x400m mixed relay quartet in qualifying for the 2025 World Athletics Championships in Tokyo later this year. They're just brilliant. Charlene Maudsley, as always, very impressive as she stormed across the line in the women's relay with like a good 15 metres to spare.
Good weekend for Louth football and Irish athletics. Bad weekend for the Camogie Association, who likely keep having bad weekends until they relent and join the rest of us in the 21st century. Meanwhile, there was an award ceremony with some celebs present.
Yesterday, the best of British talent, along with some Irish and Hollywood types, made their way to the Royal Festival Hall in London for the TV BAFTAs. I don't know if you were brave enough to stay up last night and catch as much of it as you could. Some great moments from the ceremony, not least this one where Ruth Jones showed up as Nessa to accept Best Female Performance in a Comedy.
I'm not going to lie, this is immense. I wasn't expecting to win this, no way. I've won a BAFTA before, of course I have, in 1976. It was the Barry Arcade Fruity Technician Award. And I was grateful for that, but this is cracking. I really wasn't expecting to win this, so the person I would like to thank most is my dear, dear, talented, lovely, kind, funny friend, James Corden, with whom I have shared this astonishing journey for the past 17 years, and without whom Nessa Shanessa Jenkins would simply not exist. I love you, James. I love writing with you. Long may it continue. Thank you so much, Becca.
Oh, she was very cool. That Female Performance in a Comedy Award was, of course, for Gavin and Stacey. The finale, which aired on Christmas Day and raked up almost 20 million viewers by New Year, which is pretty impressive. Northern Ireland police drama Blue Lights also did well, getting a BAFTA for Best Drama Series. The show stars Sian Brooke, Catherine Devlin, Nathan Braniff and Richard Dormer, and it's set in current days based at the fictional Blackthorn Police Station in Belfast. Some of the overall big winners were Mr. Loverman, a black LGBT story from the BBC that got both leading and supporting actor nods. Baby Reindeer's Jessica Gunning was recognised for her acting, and ITV's Mr. Bates versus the Post Office got the Golden Mask for a limited drama series. Children's TV, incidentally, when I was looking down the winners, that has seriously smartened up since my day. Best Children's Scripted Award went to CBeebies As You Like It at Shakespeare's Globe. Not a Gregory Grognog in sight. Take note, RTE Junior. Give the kids what they want. Seamus and Sheila MacSpud do Hamlet. Other Irish interests, incidentally, Rivals had 6 nominations, starring Irish actors Aidan Turner and Victoria Smurfit. Nicola Coughlan's Big Mood was nominated for Female Performance in a Comedy. Say Nothing was up in the international category, and Graham Norton was nominated in his usual entertainment performance.
And that's the wrap up of the Checks Notes TV BAFTAs from Sunday night. Are we not entertained? Blink once for yes, twice for no. That's where we leave the Dermot Whelan-powered monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan. This morning, Claire Byrne welcomed author and artist Aoife Dooley and author Shane Hegarty into studio this morning to talk about graphic novels and picture books for children.
And Aoife, I was telling you as you sat down that my 7-year-old read your book cover to cover at the weekend and was so proud of herself. And that's kind of the point, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think it's just amazing to see kids pick up graphic novels now and be encouraged to read graphic novels. And there's just such a big sense of accomplishment when they finish a book as well. Because, like, as we were talking about, it could be like 300 pages and it's they can read it in like less than 2 hours sometimes.
That was her whole joy, that it was a long book that was solid and big, but she managed to sit down and read it herself in one sitting from cover to cover without anyone helping her.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's such an accomplishment, and the kids get so excited when they finish a book as well and they've next one. So it's like, it is what it's all about, I think.
So for you, Shane, how important are the pictures?
Well, funny, I was thinking about it on the way in, and I have to say, Aoife's books are hugely popular in my house as well. And there's one thing about, you know, just having the pictures and the story and whatever in it, it has to be good.
Yes.
And I know that, that the reason Aoife's books are so popular in my house is because they grab from the first page and all the way through.
Yeah. And there's a hair competition in the most recent one, which was really important in our house.
But I find that I was thinking about this, and I realised I used to read a lot of what we kind of maybe now call graphic novels when I was younger. So I was a big Asterix fan.
Oh, yeah.
I used to read Tintin. I used to read the Marvel comics. And in fact, went back as an adult and bought a lot of those older comics, real man-child stuff, when I was older. And then my son started reading them as well. And so in some ways, I think it's always that interest in pictures has always been there with everyone. But what's happened now is maybe we finally caught up to an extent so that kids... You know, like kids start with pictures a lot of the time. You know, picture books they start with are obviously kind of picture books. Mm-hmm. And then there was a stage when I was younger where it kind of jumped from pictures into words. And now we just have so many absolutely brilliant books that put the two things together.
Yeah.
And you can really see that. You walk into the bookshop now and sure, they're just jumping off the shelves.
Maybe as adults, we don't really get it. Because I remember when we in our house were stuck in a dog man phase, I was sort of panicking about that, going, no, he's too big to be reading that book. He needs to read other books and stop rereading them, and they're picture books. And I didn't need to worry. It's great that they're reading, right?
It is. And what happens is that they find, I think the one thing that parents often and adults often worry about is sort of what they're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways you have to be guided by what they want to read. And I know from in my own house that the kids in my house read different things. Some love the really illustrated books. And then, I have a girl who just loves the big, thick novels. And so they're kind of, you know, I think sometimes what they can do, though, is they do act as that really great introduction into books as well. So if they are struggling, and if you are struggling as a reader, or you're worried about your a young reader in your house, just bring them into the bookshop, and you will find they might gravitate towards those graphic novels first, and find a lot in them. And sometimes they'll just stay with those, and sometimes then they'll kind of lead them on to. I mean, so many of the books now are very graphically illustrated. Anyway, even the ones that are sort of more kind of traditional chapter books.
Yeah. And Aoife, for you, is it enough for a parent to bring the child into the library or the bookshop? Do you have to know what you're looking for?
I think it's changing now. I think, like, when I was younger, I think, like, you know, a teacher wouldn't dare read a graphic novel in class. Like, it wouldn't even be considered a book, I think. So, like, now that's changing. And I think that, like, the content in graphic novels as well can be, you know, it can have really good messages. And I think teachers are using that now in schools to kind of teach kids, like, about, like, certain topics and, you know. And I think they're just becoming, I think we've just caught up with ourselves, like what Shane's saying. I think it's always been there, but people are now seeing how useful and how effective they can be and how inclusive they can be as well for other kids who may not be able to keep up in a class, and you can read the book together. So I think graphic novels are magic.
Yeah.
I think they're magic.
How does it start for you? Is it the story first or the picture?
Oh, it changes all the time. It's like I might see the story in my head first and then I'll do a few pictures based on it to see how it works. But typically how I've been doing it is I write the script first and then I do up the panels and rough sketches and then the illustration. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes when you have your favourite book adapted for television or film and you switch it on, really going to enjoy this, and the lead character looks nothing like the person you'd pictured in your head, and it's a disjointed experience. Does that concern you at all with
No, the amazing thing. So I've been lucky enough to work with brilliant illustrators in my books. So with The Shop of Impossible Ice Creams is Jeff Crowther.
We've just gone back to that in our house, I was telling you, yeah.
And I've never met Jeff. I've never met him. He lives in the States and everything is done remotely, you know. And then I've worked with Ben Mantle, who does the Boot books.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, what happens is that I write the story and then Jeff or Ben has got those books and they've added to it. They've kind of taken this thing that's in my head and they've made it better.
But so, do you not get a picture sometimes? This has to happen occasionally where you go, no, Limpet doesn't look like that.
There might be a little bit of tweaking, but what if... It's always really reassuring when it comes back in a way that reflects what you had in your head. And I think it shows that it sort of reassures you that the story is strong, but also that the illustrator is getting it and they're bringing so much to it. And when I talk to classes or festivals or libraries or wherever I am talking to a group of kids, the amount of times that I'll be talking to them about the story and I show them loads of the pictures. So I really rely on those pictures and, you know, on the presentation that I show them. But they'll have drawn the pictures themselves while I'm talking to them. And you realise that that the visual element is so important to them, and they really respond to it. So when the two things come together like that, and I'm always amazed by the, by people like Aoife who can do both things, because I cannot
do them.
It.
You need to show them how to do both.
But the kids really do respond to it. And they're, I mean, you'll know this, Aoife, you're younger than me now. There's much more of a visual thing. This younger generation is far more visual anyway, because they're so used to screens all the time. Mm-hmm. They're so used to looking at kind of moving images and pictures and all of that all the time. So I think they definitely respond to it in a way that's really noticeable.
Does that play a role, Aoife, the fact that they're seeing more pictures now all of the time on devices?
I think so. I think that's another reason why I think graphic novels are so digestible, because this, I don't know if this is a bit controversial, but I feel like with like social media and stuff, I feel like people's attention spans has got smaller. So,
for sure.
You know, I think it's easier to read a book in a day than it is over the space of a few days. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a bad thing when it comes to kids, because kids are still reading. And it's like, you know, kids are looking at books going, okay, no, I can still read this. It's like, you know, but I do think that plays a part in it. Yeah, with social media and just how fast we digest things now. It's like sometimes, like, you know, you might not stay and watch like a 5 or 6 second video. So it's like, yeah. I think that kind
you
of...
You have to capture them and,
yes,
and reel them in.
I think so. And but I do agree with Shane though as well. Like when you work with the right illustrator, they sometimes just get it when they're reading the story. Mm-hmm. And I've actually seen this on the opposite side, where I've been working as a writer with someone else who's an illustrator on a different project, and I've seen them illustrate a story that I had done, and I'd never been on the opposite side before, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I know exactly where Shane's coming from, where he's like, oh yeah, no, I can see these characters, like it's like exactly what I was kind of expecting.
What I expected, yeah.
Illustrator and author Aoife Dooley, together with author Shane Hegarty, talking graphic novels and picture books for children on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne.
Is Dublin, where there are plenty of opportunities to stay active and lead a healthy lifestyle.
This is Deckard, the PE robot. I see what they did there by calling him Deckard. Deckard, along with Professor Derek O'Keefe and Professor Cornelia Connolly from the University of Galway, joined Ray Darcy in studio this afternoon to talk about how humanoid robots can help humans get more active.
So he's comes from the Hive Lab at the University of Galway, so we do a lot of work in digital health, bringing technology solutions to patient care. And he comes from that lab, from that ethos of trying to find, you know, technology that can improve human health. So in this case, Deckard is about preventative healthcare. So about, you know, starting conversations about how to improve your cardiovascular health, or as you mentioned with Pieta, he did the Darkness into Light walk in the Phoenix Park. And, you know, that started a lot of conversations about mental health. And we call that project Tin Man, because like the Wizard of Oz, you know, in search of empathy, you know, Deckard here started that.
Just tell me about the actual, like, because you bought it like a shell or a skeleton, and then you give it a name and a personality. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, exactly. So the way I describe it is like the robot's just a piece of technology. So it's like if you buy a laptop and it's got Microsoft Word on it, and your job then is to, you know, use that word processor to write Harry Potter, you know, whatever kind of creative use you have for your laptop. So in this case, it's a robot shell. We program it here, Max and Hamandra and the rest of the team here at the Hive Lab. We say we want to use this in healthcare, so we use a large language model to program it and to write its personality, as it were. And then we develop the autonomous software stack to allow it to move and interact. It's got LiDAR and cameras and everything else. So,
You're a physician ear.
Physician ear, yeah, that's the title.
Physician
ear.
Not a great word to say.
Yeah, I guess. So the idea is I'm trained as a physician, so a medical doctor, but then also as an engineer.
Yes.
And the idea there is that, you know, engineers tend to be very solutions oriented, logical. And then in the clinical world, in the world of medicine, there's a lot of clinical problems, and nothing's ever black and white. It's always a spectrum of color. So if you're a physician here, you have that kind of dual skill set of seeing a problem, but then being able to come up with a solution for it. So we've done a lot of that.
And of course, robots have been used in medicine, particularly surgery, for quite some time, haven't they?
They have, yeah. The Da Vinci robot is probably the most famous one that actually goes in and actually, you know, can peel a grape. It can do all kinds of urological surgical procedures. But I think in the next couple of years, you're going to see more of these humanoid robots. And again, it's fantastic that Ireland's, you know, leading the way on this. The Pieta Walk the other day was the first time a humanoid robot did a charity walk in the world, the first time a robot raised money for right. humans. But in the next few years, we have robot vacuum cleaners, you have robot lawnmowers. We don't yes. even blink now when we see them. What we're starting to see are these humanoid robots emerging. There's about 20 companies worldwide producing these robots. So they're going to start to infiltrate into our lives in a very useful way as a tool.
You see, that's an interesting word, isn't it? Infiltrate. there's sort of like, that's something dark about the word infiltrate, isn't there?
Well, they're never going to replace humans, but they're definitely going to support us, I think, in our behaviours. And so, like in medicine or in education, they'll be there to support populations that need that a little bit of additional support. So whether that's a child learning a new language or learning mathematics, or indeed, like some people with autism spectrum disorder, it has been proven that robots can support those populations where humans can learn behaviours from the robots. And it's having positive impact.
And that's your area of expertise, education.
Yeah, so kind of similar to Derek, I studied computer engineering and now I'm in the School of Education. So I blend the engineering and the education disciplines.
So you're an engineer.
Well, no, I don't have a fancy title like that.
Okay. So you would see in years to come that teachers would have assistant robots?
Possibly. Like as I say, they certainly are not going to replace the teachers
no.
or anything like that. But they're there as a support for cognitive support and for social support for young people and for children. There's certain possibilities for that. Yeah. And it's really like last week we brought the robot to a school in Galway. And, you know, just students learn so much more from the interaction with the physical humanoid robot. So it just brings a lot of joy to learn. Learning, and that's, you know, gives us enthusiasm.
Yes, because I was reading and because it's novel.
Yes.
You know, in years to come, robots won't be novel.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes,
you know, so you're getting people to interact and engage with them now because there's a novelty factor. In years to come, that won't be there. Anyway, that's down the road. That's down the road. So can you ask Deckard a question, Derek?
Yeah. So, for example, we can ask him. So, Deckard, tell us about your work with Pieta. Try that again.
Yeah.
Deckard, tell us about your work with Pieta.
Yeah, he's shy. It happens an awful lot. People come in, you know, they're talking about... Sorry, Deckard. Yeah, because he was very talkative outside.
Well, Ray, yes. I had the pleasure of participating in Pieta's Darkness into Light charity walk as Project Tinman this weekend. It was truly inspiring to see so many people come together to raise awareness about mental health and support those who may be struggling. Just like Tinman in The Wizard of Oz, I wanted to show that the heart is not just a muscle, but a symbol of courage, empathy, and support. It was a fantastic experience, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to contribute to such an important cause.
It's mad because I'm making eye contact with him because that's
it's like a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
a human psychology behavior. What's also interesting is that we know how humans teach other humans, like, you know, pedagogy. We know how humans teach other species like dolphins and, you know, dogs how to do tricks. It's very interesting to think about, you know, the next couple of years, how humans respond to education from a robot. Like, what's the best way for a robot to teach a human something? And that's a very useful thing because, unfortunately, in healthcare, there actually isn't enough doctors and nurses there. So by 2030, the WHO thinks there's going to be a 10 million shortfall. And so if there's ways that robots can help, you know, even with educational stuff to improve, you know, patients' understanding of their conditions, that's really important. So having those social cues, as you mentioned, is super important.
And obviously in the future, you know, I'm sure it's available now, but that quite robotic voice that Deckard has... You could put any voice in there, couldn't you?
Yeah, we could put any voice, literally. Yeah, any voice. We could put your voice in there.
Yes, yeah.
Clone you.
Yeah. And everything's going to get quicker, isn't it? And faster.
I think the best example is probably like smartphones. So, you know, smartphones now, they're just ubiquitous. You never really look at your phone and say, wow, that's an amazing piece of technology.
Well, I do.
But if you think back to 2006, yeah. 2007, and when Steve Jobs came out on the stage, and you had like a phone with an internet device, with a camera, media player... It was just, you know, mind-blowing. So
you have a list of qualifications, the length of your arm, and all the big, you've Harvard, NASA, the Mayo Clinic, Oxford. So you've been around.
Lots of college.
So you've thought about this, I would imagine. So, like, people are genuinely fearful, and probably that's because how robots have been depicted in fiction, isn't it? They always end up taking over the world.
Yeah, because I think that's kind of dramatic, and that's what, you know, people like is drama, and they like to watch movies or read books that have that. The truth is that the robot or the AI, since you mentioned it, they're just tools. They're like technology. At every period in human evolution, there's been, you know, a new technology, be that electricity or be that computers or cell phones. The internet, when it came out a few years ago, everyone was throwing their hands in the air saying, you know, this is going to replace all professionals, and it didn't, you know. So it's just a tool, and that's all it is.
Yeah, but we instruct them. But what if our instructions are misread?
Yeah, so again, back to the movies, there's three different types of AI. There's narrow AI, which is what we have in 2025, which is just pattern recognition, really. Logistic regression, spotting big patterns in, patterns in big data sets. We're moving into the world of what's called general artificial intelligence. That's when the robot has the same, you know, kind of intellectual ability as a human, because, you know, all of us can pattern recognize as humans, which is what a robot can excel at. But the robot can't do lots of things that you're able to do, like open a door, you know, think about art, you know, think about creativity.
Yeah. Misuse a word. Maybe they can misuse a word. Yeah.
But I suppose the point is that we're still, you know, away from that probably the next couple of years. And then beyond that is what you have in the movies, which is artificial superintelligence, which is basically the Terminators and so on. And I think, you know, the jury's out about, you know, when we're going to get there as an artificial superintelligence. But again, it's a tool. Think of the positive here.
That's Professor Derek O'Keefe, physician-eer from the University of Galway, emphasising the positive aspects of machines rising up to destroy all of humanity. Professor O'Keefe was on this afternoon's Ray D'Arcy Show with his colleagues, Professor Cornelia Connolly and Deckard, the murderous humanoid PE robot. One of the voices that will always be associated with Liveline is that of voiceover artist Jonathan Ryan, one of Ireland's best-known VO artists. Jonathan got on the line this morning to talk to Dermot Whelan.
715-815. There's a live one for you now.
Oh, my God. It's Dermot here, Jonathan. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, because I remember you. Maybe you don't want people to remember this, but I remember you from your Bosco days.
Well, now, I was the original presenter, the original voice of Bosco in the pilot series in 1979.
Mm.
And I actually operated the little puppet, so I know all his secrets. I can't remember how many programs we did, but it was to give us all a little bit of an up into television presenting, because none of us had any experience of it. And also, Joe O'Donnell wanted to test the waters of the country. Did the country need a preschool program, and boy, did they need it!
Absolutely,
and there you go. Yeah. So once it was up and running, they got Miriam Lambert in from the puppet Lambert Puppet Theatre, and she could fit into the box more easily than I could, and she wouldn't have to wear the tight underpants to get the high pitched voice like I had to.
Well,
it was terrible.
Do you remember the day you recorded the famous Joe phone number, and did you re-record it, or was it just the one that lasted all through the years?
It was the original one lasted for years, and there occasionally there'd be additions to it on stings and special promotions and so on. But as regards the high-pitched shouting voice, it could be me, but I'm not sure if it is me. I could do you a live impression of it now, and you could tell me what you think.
Well, let's have a listen to the one I think you're referring to, because this is iconic.
Joe Duffy. Okay, now see if I can do that, okay? If you hold, just get back from the mic and the speaker there.
Okay, go
Joe
for it.
Joe Duffy! Does that sound like me?
I don't know. I think the jury could be out. If it isn't you, perhaps the original Joe Duffy person will actually contact us.
We're all doing it now. You see, you're doing it now. Maybe it was you.
I wish it was, but I guess, you know, it's the things around the show stick in people's memory as much as the show itself. And I guess for you, it must be nice to have been a part of such an iconic show for so many years.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really was. Yeah. And I only met Joe once or twice. Lovely, delightful man. I was in the radio rep for a while, so I had a bit of a thing about radio drama. And I wrote a little play called Talk to Joe. But I was told very politely by RTE, no, we can't have a play about one of our presenters who's currently on air. So, but maybe now.
Now the door is wide open.
I hear the hinges creaking.
You know what, Jonathan? You know, you obviously, we remember your voice for the Joe Duffy show, Reasons. But you've been in our psyche, in our cultural psyche for decades because you've done so many ads, and particularly at a time when ads were almost appointment viewing. Like if there was a new ad that came on TV, particularly for those of us in two channel land down the west, you watch the ads with the same excitement and intrigue that you did the main shows. And there was one that you were the voice of, and I think this will go down in history as one of Ireland's most iconic ads.
I miss about home is the rain and the greenness and the pint of harp. And the evening before us, and friends coming in, and the pint of harp, and Sally O'Brien and the way she might look at you, and joining the chorus, and the pint of harp.
Sally O'Brien.
You see, that's very speeded. The engineer who recorded that ad in 1980, Paddy Gibbons, the legendary Paddy Gibbons, He, when I mentioned that to him, that I'd seen it on TV or something, a thing about ads on Irish television, they said it's very speeded to match the pictures. Because I sound very candid, I sound very camp there. And so that's what I miss about home is the rain and the greenness. Oh dear. You know, that's what it sounds like. But I didn't sound like that then. I have a much deeper voice than that. So. And Frank Sheeran really liked what I did, but he put me through the mill to get the read out of me.
Yeah.
Because I was very inexperienced at the time.
Well, it was worth it, wasn't it? Because it stuck with us. I do remember people saying they built a fake beach for that ad down in Wicklow, near Lugala or someplace down there.
Yes.
For the, you know, frying the egg on the stones was actually somewhere down in Wicklow. And you know what?
If you had an egg.
If you had an egg. There was another one, Jonathan, that is also close to my heart because I remember acting this out in a home movie. I had my own version of this particular ad. It's one that you did with Twink, and it was for the very glamorous product of toilet roll.
Oh, yes.
His lordship's family insist on Jumbo's, the better value bathroom tissue.
Jumbo's, for that extra softness, strength and length. And long. How long would you say these Jumbo's are, Rose Violet?
About as long as it took you to get up here, Bernie.
I mean, you couldn't reuse toilet paper. You know what I mean, Bernie?
But I do. Somewhere there's a video of me somewhere stored on either a VHS tape deep in an attic or maybe on a hard drive somewhere of me going, about as long as it took you to get up here, Rose Bernie.
There you go. Yeah.
But it's funny. It's only when you hear these ads, you realise that the dialogue and the music and all that stuff is stored away in these little mini files
absolutely.
In the back of our brain somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I did my first voiceover in 1980, April Fool's Day, 1980. And I'm still doing them.
I know. We hear you all the time. And I mean, did you ever think that would be essentially your bread and butter over decades? Or did you think at the time it was just going to sort of fill in some blanks when you acted and did everything else?
No, I didn't at all, because I hadn't a clue how to do a voiceover. I mean, it isn't easy. It isn't as easy as it sounds. I mean, it's so often where the client would be there in the studio and say, oh, I'd like to do my own voiceovers. And they go in and they freeze when they get on the mic. And they hear themselves. They hear themselves in the cans. They go, oh, Jesus, well, I didn't realize I sounded like that and so on. But it takes a while to become a good voiceover, and you become a good voiceover.
Yeah.
And then you work away. I was lucky that I was versatile with my voice.
Well, if there's anybody listening who'd like to get into the game of voiceover artistry, would you have any advice for them?
Yeah, don't make it sound like you're reading it.
Advice for budding voiceover artists from a veteran of the industry. That's Liveline voiceover man Jonathan Ryan talking to Dermot Whelan this morning. Doom scrolling is, according to a new and not at all surprising study, it's called doom scrolling, for goodness sakes, bad for our mental health. Claire Byrne was joined this morning by one of the authors of that study, Professor Tali Sharot. Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London and MIT.
What led you to begin this line of research? How did you come to it?
The research in my lab, we're very interested in how information seeking relates to mental health. And so looking at what people browse and how that relates to how they feel and symptoms was an obvious step. Most of the research in this kind of field looks at screen time. So how much time do you spend on your phone or on your computer? But we thought, well, that's perhaps not the best measure. You can do all sorts of things online, and it's important to look at exactly what you're doing and what content you're consuming. And that may be even more related to your mental health and to your mood.
So in order to put this research together, it must have been a complex task, a lot more than just basic data gathering, which would lead you just to the screen time finding, but you wanted to see more and find out more.
Right. So what we did is we asked more than 1,000 individuals to go online just at home, browse the internet a few days, about 20 to 30 minutes each time, and then send us their browsing history. So then we can use our browsing history to look at all the web pages. We use an algorithm to do that. We look at all the web pages they browse. We take the text out of the web pages, and then we scored the text on how positive or negative the text is, again, using algorithms.
Okay, so you needed to understand the type of content that people were consuming.
Yeah, we're specifically interested in the sentiment. So how positive or negative. You can look at a lot of other characteristics and measures, but that's the one that we thought may be quite related to people's mental state.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people who regularly use social media, for example, will know about the endless scrolling and how time consuming it can be. And it's often called the doom loop. What did you find out about that, about the doom loop, and how we and what we're doing, we're feeding it and it's continuing because we are continuing?
Yeah. So what we found is that people with worse mental health are more likely to go online and consume negative information. So the searches that they conduct online tend to result in more negative information. And as a result, that negative information actually makes their symptoms worse. So that's kind of a feedback loop. Right. Mm-hmm. You're feeling worse, you're worse mental health, you go online, consume more negative information, makes you even worse.
So you're seeking that out as opposed to being fed it by an algorithm, because I know that you didn't have access, did you, to people's social media feeds?
Right. So we couldn't look at anything with a password. And so that excluded social media. We mostly looked at either web pages that you go in directly or things that you search on Google. And so we also saw that not only there's kind of a correlation between how you're feeling and your mental health and what you're looking at online, but also we could test for causation, meaning what is causing what. And we did that by taking two groups of people. One group, we gave them negative web pages to consume, and the other, we gave them neutral web pages to consume. And as you'd expect, those individuals that we gave them the negative web page ended up feeling worse after they consumed them relative to before. And then now we have two groups. One, we actually manipulated their mood, so now it's negative. The other is not. And we told them, go online and search for whatever you like. And we found that those individuals which we manipulated their mood to be more negative ended up going online and consuming more negative information. So this suggests it's not only correlational, but it's causation. Mm-hmm. Your mental health can cause you to go online and consume negative information, and negative information causes your symptoms to become worse.
Right. So then you have this, the opposite to a virtual circle. Does it work in the other way if you're feeding positive stories and positive links and positive content to people? Does that lift the mood?
So the relationship to positive was weaker. There were some indications that there is a relationship, but it wasn't a robust relationship. It wasn't something that we could see again and again. So it definitely wasn't as strong and clear as a relationship to negative information. I suspect it probably is there, but not quite strong enough for us to be confident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is this research telling you, do you believe?
Well, I think it suggests that, you know, one thing you might want to do is monitor what kind of content you're consuming, and perhaps be more conscious of what you're doing online. And in fact, to help people do that, we developed a plugin and an app. So the app, what it does, it shows you over a day or over the week what kind of information you consumed, how negative or positive it is. So you might look and you see, oh, I've consumed a lot of negative information over the week. You know, maybe this is why I'm feeling not great. The plugin shows you, you go on Google and you can search for whatever you like and you find the results like you do normally. But next to each result, you also have free scores next to the link. One result, one score tells you how positive or negative the information is on that website. The other tells you how much on average it will enhance people's knowledge. And the other tells you how much on average it can be actionable. It can help you make decisions or take actions. And using that, you may be able to browse the web in a more kind of conscious way, a more goal-oriented way, right? You might, if you're coming home and you're feeling bad, you might not click on that negative webpage. But if you're looking to how to get a visa, you might click on the one that has a high actionable score. So we're hoping that the kind of combination of the app and the plugin may help people just have more agency and kind of empower them when they're going online.
Solutions to counter the ill effects of too much internet usage? Sounds like a conspiracy to me. Kidding. That's Professor Tali Sharot, Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London and MIT, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about how to avoid doom scrolling. On this afternoon's Liveline, Porrick spoke to Katie Hannan, sitting in for Joe Duffy, about how he wants to find a home for his late father's classical music collection.
It's one of those things where I suppose myself and my siblings probably should have paid a bit more attention to Dad's love of this music. But this is a rather large collection of entirely classical music. My dad was vice principal of the St. Muiredix College in Ballina for years and retired many years ago, but he passed away 3 years ago, and Dad purpose-built a rather large cabinet that went wall-to-wall and floor-to-ceiling with about 2,200 classical records. Now, these records, 90% of them, Katie, are the old-style shellac 78-type records. They're a heavy record. Many of them are only recorded on one side, so they would be very early ones going back to possibly the 1910s onwards.
When you say shellac, this is like the stuff people put on their nails now, is it?
No, good point. I don't put anything on my own nails, so I don't know. But yes, I think it's a form of a wax or vinyl that was done a long, long time ago to record voice on, and then it moved to vinyl in the 50s, and obviously now we don't have. Well, we're back to vinyl again. But shellac would have been this very old, but it's a very heavy record, so it was pre-vinyl, and that would be so. There'd be probably only a small number of people who'd kind of remember shellac type records.
And would they play on a regular record player?
Well, funnily enough, now, while they were gramophone specific, I do remember my dad had a record, a turntable, and interesting, it was a memory that just jumped to my mind there before I was chatting to you. I remember himself and an old and a previous DG of RT, George Waters, both sitting on the floor of our house wiring together a sound system to a record player that actually could play, as long as it plays at 78 RPM, you can play these records on them.
Right. And when you say classical, like what music are we talking about?
We're talking about Mozart's, Beethoven's, Wagner's, that type of music. So it's all symphonic type music, and then it would also be Dad's favourite, which would have been opera, and he would have had opera singers like Caruso, McCormick, Margaret Burke Sheridan, Maria Callas, all of those older style sopranos and tenors and baritones and basses singing some of the classical arias from opera. So that's what I'm talking about, that classic style. So
would you have grown up listening to, you know, arias from operas
Dear God, yeah, dear God, yes. Sometimes, because opera never kind of floated my boat. I much prefer the symphonic stuff, which Dad would play. You'd often get some Verdi played in, like the Anvil Chorus, or you know, you might get something like the Thieving Magpie, or some other beautiful pieces of Rossini and stuff like that. But Dad would play an awful lot of opera, and we would have heard it. He would have piped it in through. The dedicated room with all the records would have one record player, and then he would pipe another record player in through the kitchen when we'd be having dinner. So perhaps over Christmas time, we would hear opera, we would hear symphony, we would hear that quite a lot. Now, in the latter years, I wouldn't have been home because I left home in the mid-80s to have to get a job and things like that. So Dad would have played them, but Dad would have also played them for local people who would have come in to want to listen. And there's a story that Dad used to, in his teenage years, ramble around the town with a record player and a satchel of records and play music in people's houses for them, you know?
Oh my God. And where did he get this very sophisticated, you know, taste in music from?
Excellent question, Katie. We don't know. Dad never spoke much about his parents and or his aunts and uncles, and we only can grasp small snippets of information. We did hear through a cousin of ours in Charlestown that our grandfather was quite adept at playing the mandolin and the squeeze box, so there would have been a tradition there. But Dad's dad died during the Second World War in a labor camp in Germany. So my father would have been no more than 9 years old.
Oh my God!
So himself and his brother would have been brought up by very strong women on the mother's side, and there's a strong possibility it might have come from that side of the family. So in answer to your question, that could be it.
That could be it. But you would never have met him then, obviously, your grandfather on your dad's side.
No, I was born 19 years after my... In fact, when I was born, there was only one grandparent alive, and that was my mother's mother. But no, I would have never met him, no.
But there must have been some stories. I mean, he actually ended up in a prisoner of war camp. So he obviously... He signed up with the British Army.
Probably by accident. My grandfather was a radio officer in the Merchant Marine. And he would have been trained by Marconi back in the early 1900s and then was a Marconi radio operator. We do know that he spent the last 2 years of the First World War on ships through the Mediterranean. And then, obviously, between the two wars, he would have spent a serious amount of time between passenger ships and cargo ships traversing. He was on the East India Line, so he would have traversed eastwards towards Hong Kong and through the Pacific into San Francisco, and then would have spent time on the east coast of America, traveling from New York down to the Bahamas and back up and doing stuff like that. So it was by pure accident that obviously all merchant ships and passenger ships became merchant marine when the war started in 39. So the story goes that my father and his brother, a four-year-old and a seven-year-old, dropped their dad at the train station in Ballina in 1940 and wouldn't have ever seen him again.
Oh my God, what an incredible family history.
That's Porrick talking to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline about his father's record collection and his grandfather's exploits during the Second World War. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, this morning Dermot Whelan welcomed Dunleary-Rath Down musician-in-residence Julie Feeney, who told him about taking time off from her career to care for her mother.
You had to take a step back from music to care for your mum. What was your mum's name?
Teresa.
Teresa. And where did you grow up?
Galway. So, well, actually, Mary Teresa. Mary Teresa Murphy.
Okay.
It's her maiden name, and then Teresa. Teresa was her name, or Mrs. Feeney, because she was a principal teacher for 45 years in Abenoch Boy. And
yeah.
So I don't think you sort of decide to take a step back. Sometimes in your life you think you have a plan, but then it just kind of takes a corner, you know. So I won't talk too much about them, but I have two smallies as well, two little people,
yeah,
which I adore and love. They're just like anybody does. But
you can still kind of, you can fire a child in the back of a car and you can actually go somewhere and you can perform or work. You can work around it. It, you know, it won't be ideal.
Yes.
But I haven't ever really done that really at all. But it would be possible if you had to, you know.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
When I became full-time carer, initially I was managing everything with sibling for like 3 years. So I was spending, you know, half the week in Galway and then I'd be up the other half the week trying to juggle the little one, you know, and all of that. So it was really tough going up and down because you can see when somebody is beginning to, when they're beginning to live with dementia, when you can start the early start of it, Alzheimer's in her case, you want to be there as a support. And my main goal was to try and preserve her quality of life for as long as possible, you know. And then ended up for 5 years, across 5 years, being her full-time carer. So she was with me. So she had my room and I just, you know, gave her all that. And like it didn't feel like, I never really consciously decided to do that. I mean, my fourth album, I know I've now 10 songs done, but that's like, that was, you know, 10 years ago.
I think a lot of people can relate to what you're saying in terms of you didn't plan, you didn't wake up one morning and write on your to-do list, I'm going to be a carer now.
Never
in my
wildest dreams.
I think of what they call the sandwich generation of where you've got kids, but now you find yourself having a more responsible role with elderly parents and then illness knocks on the door and things get a little bit more complicated. And I think it's always a fluid situation that you just have to adapt to, and the dynamics change all the time.
Yeah, that's true. It is definitely true. At the same time for me, even though, like, I remember I saw that Sharon Horgan, one of her brilliant TV shows, there's a scene where the brother says to the sister, you got off the hook because you've got two kids, so you're not going to have to do the job, you know. And I was thinking, wow, I'm the opposite of that. I have two smallies. But it didn't feel like, I know it's the sandwich generation, but I just sort of felt more like a unit. It just felt like the natural thing to do. And I actually think that, you know, older people, if you're in your 70s or 80s and you're being a carer, I know it was crazily difficult for me with, you know, on my own with two little children and my mum. But for somebody who's actually their 70s or 80s, I think that's really, really difficult for like a couple, you know, because everybody assumes like for 50 years they've been together. And I think that's really tough, you know, for those people, because obviously they're older. Like, you know, I'm youngish person. I was young, you know, younger doing it. So at least I was okay about literally, because it's a physical job as well. You know, it's a very physical job. It's all encompassing. And
my own mother had dementia and it was a strange experience because obviously it's a difficult one. I wonder, did you find that you think that the worst moment in the world would be when my parent doesn't recognize me? You think that's going to be just the worst. Now, it's not pleasant by any means. But actually, I found that wasn't the worst thing because it's so gradual, it's kind of happening.
Yeah.
I found the helplessness about her anxiety, that she just seemed so worried and I couldn't get through to her. What were the pieces of it that you found most challenging?
Well, I found, for me also, the not remembering. I mean, I remember the first time that happened and it was a bit of a blow, but then I realised I actually didn't care about that. I wasn't concerned in any way and she didn't disappear for me really at all, and I know she does for a lot of people and they find that. For me, she didn't disappear. She was the same person. I just saw the more beautiful sides to her. I saw the quirkier sides. I didn't realise she was as quirky. I knew she was always hilariously funny.
Yeah.
But she had to hold her station so well in her life as a principal teacher, and she'd six of us through college and everything. I got to see that beautiful side. So I think that for me, I was very interested in the sensory world. Like I found that even though, like she if you know, one time somebody said, she'd always say right to the very end, Julie, where's Julie? Where's Julie? Where's Julie? You know, and somebody said, and who's Julie? And she went, me sister, me pal, me child, you know, like it was kind of like one, you know, and I thought that was like kind of, it didn't matter. She just, it was just like the person, you know what I mean? Yeah. The person that she was with. And I think, yeah, I mean, exactly as you say, the most rewarding part for me was to try and reassure her, because like if you're with somebody every night for that length of time, the last like 5 months or so, she was in and out of, you know, various hospitals and things like that just for the last 5 months. But and I was still in with her every day. But she, like, it's reassuring her. And I found the senses, the sensory world was what really opened up for me. I'm very interested in that anyway, in a lot of the case as an artist. But like I found that the lighting, I went really into the finding the right lights, finding the right music, the timing of things, like tone of voice, and just... the two little children, she loved them as well. And the little one, she was only one and she was only two. And she actually, that was a great thing for her. So the most difficult thing is, I suppose, when we were in a bubble and we also went through the pandemic. And so, like, you know, my brother dropped in shopping to us every week. But, you know, the way it was, nobody, you couldn't have anybody. So you're completely on your own. And you're doing things like, I was doing a very important meeting on a panel for something, you know, because I obviously still an artist trying to keep your hand in at it, you know, so I did a lot of writing, but you're out, you know, you're in on this call and there's a whole lot going on behind you, and you're, every time there's a break, you're running out to remedy things. So I think what's the difficult thing is, I think it's more difficult for me that she's gone, to be honest, than kind of to see her, because I know it's a very difficult and very challenging for people when they say that the person isn't there anymore. I completely understand how they say that. For me, I just found just such a beauty, the beauty inside her. I learned so much from her, and she taught me so much too. Like, she, it's about patience. You know, the way that I became patient. I don't think I was patient before. You just, your patience, whatever about patience being challenged as a parent, I just found... It's being a carer, your patience is just like, you just have to leave it out. Just leave it all flat. Just, you have to become, I know you're an expert in all the other kind of stuff like mindfulness and all that, but you have to become, you know, kind of zen about it. And then, of course, you have to maintain your own self-worth as well, which is the whole other side of it, you know.
Singer-songwriter Julie Feeney talking to Dermot Whelan this morning about taking time off from her music career to care for her sick mother. And that's all I have for you in this AI-generated edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with a fitter, happier, more productive look back at an entire week in radio. But from me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.